Give you a second.
Well, it went off the internet, I guess.
Are you ready? Cool. And you're ready? Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for June the 7th, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of public hearing and work session on two bills, Senate Bill 98 and Senate Bill 860. We are here for the purpose of a public hearing on House Bill 2356, and as a legislative courtesy, we'll be taking these out of order. So I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2356, welcome Representative Holvey, and give the gavel back to the chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair, and again, welcome Representative Holvey. Just for everybody that's joining us today, let me indicate that the House is reconvening at 2 o'clock. This reminds me very much of when I go to a large gathering and the food is laid out on the table, and the host says, we have hors d'oeuvres for 50 or dinner for 10, and that will be decided by the first 10 people in line. So we've got a lot of ground to cover and not a lot of time to cover it in, and the time will depend on how we do at the beginning. Didn't mean to drop that on you, Representative Holvey, but that's you're first in line for dinner.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, and committee members. Appreciate the courtesy to be able to present House Bill 2356. This is an issue that has been in the House, at least, and I think on the discussing the Senate side for more than three sessions. And it deals with debt buyers, and the debt buyers are those that purchase debt and actually own the debt as a first party and aren't representing somebody else when they go to collect debt, like a debt collector. And so in the state of Oregon, debt buyers are unregulated currently. We have no statutory scheme or regulation or licensing in the state of Oregon over the debt buying industry. And it has caused some problems when consumers have complaints and our state's unable to address those complaints or issues. So that is the genesis of this discussion and House Bill 2356. The bill itself does require registration with the Department of Consumer and Business Services by debt buyers, just as debt collectors, and it also has, some pathways for the Department of Justice also to provide enforcement once the Department of Consumer and Business Services recognizes a problem for certain. So that's sort of the basics of what the bill is. It's pretty technical when you get into debt collecting. We did have a long work group on this that included the debt collectors, the state bar, the courts, law advocacy center, Encore, which is the largest, I believe, debt buyer organization or company in the nation, and also Matt Marquis with the debt collectors. And so I'm trying to think, there's probably a couple others involved in this. So it was worked on extensively in a work group, although we did have hearings on two bills, this bill, House Bill 2356, and also another House bill, House Bill 3188, which was a bill from the Debt Buyer Association as well. And so at the end of the day, we moved House Bill 2356 to the Committee on Ways and Means for your consideration. I believe that I think all of the stakeholders except for the Debt Buyer Association came out without opposing this bill, and that also, I might mention that there is a Dash 5 amendment that we worked on. It was mostly technical amendments that the Department of Revenue came back with after the policy committee had looked at that. They wanted to weigh in some more. And there was a couple other just word changes, file or bring. We had brings in it, and you know, the debt collectors felt that it should be files. It was more descriptive of what was actually going on in the bill. And so I know that the Department of Justice Attorney General Rosenblum, I thank their office very much for supporting this bill, but also, you know, really helping us walk through the legality of this. And of course, Matt Marquis with the Oregon Collectors Association and Bruce Miller with the Oregon Judicial Department were really key players, and also Rick Blackwell with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It was a huge joint effort, took a lot of time and a lot of effort, and I would commend House Bill 2356 with the Dash 5 amendment to you if you choose to adopt that. That would be the preference for me as the policy chair from Business and Labor, and I think all the stakeholders that were involved in this. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions, and if you have technical questions, I know Department of Justice here and Department of Consumer Business Services is also here to describe their portions of this bill if you so wish.
Senator Johnson. I have a technical question, but the good news is it's not for you. It's for her. Is LFO in possession of the Dash 5s?
We are. Okay. We are. Thank cool. you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Representative Holby? Thank you so much for your background work on this and for presenting it to us today.
Thank you.
But I've got four other people signed up on this bill. I'm going to bring the first three up. Cheryl Heimstra from the Department of Justice, and Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, and Elizabeth Remley from Encore. Whoever would like to go first can go ahead and introduce themselves. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomber, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Heimstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2356. As the good representative mentioned, we put a lot of work into this one. I think when the process first started out a number of sessions ago, we had about 15 big asks. This bill has been pared back to, I would say, about four, and it is a good, strong bill. Back in December, we invited a bunch of different parties to the table to discuss our legislative draft, including the Debt Buyers Association, the debt collectors, and many others. We heard and got some great feedback from the debt collectors, from Encore, and many other stakeholders. The Debt Buyers Association did decide to drop their own bill, but the bill coming out of the committee unanimously was House Bill 2356. We did incorporate some concerns, for a lot of different concerns from the Debt Collectors and Debt Buyers Association, taking out an insurance provision in there that would have required $2 million worth of insurance. after hearing the rebuttal on that, we did incorporate just rulemaking for DCBS to figure out what the appropriate number should be so they could have some time to really dig into that. Same thing with the fees for the program for DCBS. You heard Representative Holby sort of explain the bill. The issue here is just a lot of cases are getting filed in Oregon Small Claims Court, over 300,000 in the last 5 years, and there's over a 95% default rate, meaning nobody shows up to defend themselves. So just a fix here of getting some more information up front.
Give me those two numbers again.
300,000 cases in the last 5 years in Oregon Small Claims Court alone.
And 90% default rate?
Over 95% default rate.
95%. Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
Yes. So the bill just gives more information to consumers in the pleadings in court so they know who actually is suing them, and more information about the debt that they are alleged to owe. It also does just prohibit suing past the statute of limitations. That was another complaint we saw a lot on our consumer complaint hotline. Does what we call the Porter v. Hill fix, which means you can't sue the wrong person. You have to have actual documentation, so showing that the correct person with the correct amount is the one you're suing.
Could we have that in other bills? You can't sue the wrong person?
I think that would be great. And then finally, a fix for collectors who are collecting protecting against debt that has actually already been covered by OHP or Medicaid, which the Oregon Law Center brought to our attention. And finally, DCBS licensing, as you heard before. The Dash 5 amendment we do support. We did reach out to the Oregon Judicial Department, DCBS, DOJ, Oregon Law Center, Center for Responsible Lending, the Collectors Association, Encore, and the Debt Buyers Association did not hear any objection to those Dash 5s. So we would commend those to you. And happy to answer questions if you have any.
Well, thank you. Why don't we hold questions until we've heard from everybody in this panel. Thank you, Ms. Heemstra.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also here in support of House Bill 2356A with the Dash 5 amendments. Just really would only add that from our client's perspective, as you know, we represent people who are low income. We often hear from people who have not understood or received pleadings that gave them information to realize that there was a case pending against them, and often don't understand that there has been any judgment against them until they go to pay their rent or their heat bill or their electricity bill and realize that their account has been garnished for a debt they didn't know existed. And so, as you might imagine, that throws people into great chaos and has all sorts of ramifications and consequences that make it harder for people to get housing and to get employment and to get credit, et cetera. So we really appreciate having been involved for the last number of sessions in trying to bring this bill forward, and the effort that Representative Holvey and Department of Justice and all of the stakeholders have really made to really find a sweet spot moving forward. And we think this is a reasonable bill that will allow debt collectors and debt buyer associations to thrive while also protecting consumers from inappropriate and invalid debt collection. So I would just offer our great support and thanks.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hebb. Good afternoon.
Hi, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Encore Capital, the nation's largest debt buyer. They're also a member of the Debt Buying Association, in support of House Bill 2356 and the Dash 5 amendments, which are technical amendments, including one that we had asked for and that the Department of Justice graciously offered to put in the bill. We appreciate the process that the Department of Justice has led. We appreciate all the work that Paul Holvey's done and worked with Sybil and others over several sessions to get this right. We appreciate the patience that people have had while we've tried to figure this out. Encore is very proud of its history in consumer protection. They think they lead the standards in consumer protection. And this bill, while it's not the one that Encore would have written, is one that puts really great consumer protection standards in our laws while still allowing us to do business in this state. So we encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Remley. Any questions for this group? Yes, Senator.
If I may, just a simple question. As far as you know, is there anyone or any stakeholders that are in opposition to the Dash 5 and or the bill? Do we pretty much have unanimity?
Go ahead.
Co-Chair Johnson, Gomberg, Senator Hansel. I heard no opposition to the Dash 5s. I sent that out a few weeks ago via email to all the stakeholders. As far as the bill itself is concerned, we did have a unanimous vote out of the House Business and Labor Committee. The Debt Buyers Association might have some concerns yet. I haven't really heard from them even after sending out the Dash 5, so they might be here to discuss anything. I'm not sure.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? All right. Thank you all. And Mr. Tribbett, you are signed up. And is there anybody else who came to testify on 2356 today? Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Ryan Tribbett, here today on behalf of the Receivables Management Association, also known formerly as the DBA International, the Debt Buyers Association. Here, not so much in opposition to what is in the bill, but having concerns about a few things that are not in the bill. We tried to get a couple of provisions put in that we think are really important. We think they're small, but important ones that have to do with helping avoid creating undue burdens on small businesses or creating an unreasonable sort of barrier to entry into what we believe is a legitimate industry. One of them is that we believe that the license fee, when the license is created from the agency, we have envisioned that there's only going to be probably 30 licenses created. And so we think the cost of that individually per license, should be weighted, and that the smaller businesses should pay pay lesser amount for the lesser administrative burden that they're going to be causing through having fewer transactions and just their volume being much lower than the larger companies. We believe the previous version of the bill, we were comfortable with the amount of insurance that was required in the previous version of the bill. It said that anyone with gross receipts over $10 million would have to carry $2 million of insurance, and anyone below $10 million of gross receipts could carry just $1 million. We actually dabbled at it for a time with our certification. The national certification we offer had a $2 million insurance requirement, and what we found out from our members was that that insurance product actually is not available for really small businesses, and for the larger businesses that were able to obtain that product, it was very high. It was like north of $30,000 a year to obtain that policy. And so if the agency, we understand that the $2 million has been taken out and it's been gone in the current version, it just gives it as the purview of the agency, which we're comfortable with the agency having rate-setting authority. But we think it is prudent to have a high-end cap on that so that it doesn't go up to that $2 million. So we're suggesting in the A7 amendment that that would have a high-end cap in statute of $1 million. Then the final thing that we would like to see in the rules is we'd like to see some call out that the agency will treat minor violations as different than sort of the really serious infractions. When you're looking at the potential penalty of revoking someone's license for as great a time as 7 years, if you look at some of the violations that might be included, if you were, and it's looking at other states, you could be late by a week on, say, a license renewal payment in another state, and if that resulted in a suspension of your license, even a short period of time like that, in Oregon, you could have your license revoked for up to 7 years as the penalty for that, even if you never really broke a law or caused any consumer harm. And so we think these are small changes. We think the bill's really close. I think that we, since you're addressing policy amendments here, let's just take that one more moment to get it right and make sure that we're not harming small businesses as we provide these important consumer protections. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tribbett. Are all of your concerns addressed in the Dash 7s?
The Dash 7s, we got back just an hour before this hearing, and it has been reviewed by our client and signed off on as addressing all of our concerns. And if the Dash 7 is adopted by this committee, we would offer our support for the bill.
All right. Ms. Pushman, do we have the Dash 7s yet?
No.
They haven't been received, Mr. Co-Chair. They haven't been received by LFO yet, but we're working with Mr. Tribbett to get them.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Tribbett? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we are only scheduled for a public hearing on this bill today, so for those of you that have interest in 2356, I'll remind you, are of course on 1 hour notice, that the events in the building are very fluid, so stay tuned and keep track should this come back on the agenda very soon. And I'd encourage you, if you have a lot of interest in this bill, to look around the room, and if you see it posted with short notice, to call the people that are sitting on either your left or your right and let them know too. All right. Anything else that we need to cover on the public hearing? All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2356. I am going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 98. And Ms. Pushman, do you want to tell us a little bit about 98?
I can. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
And excuse me, while you're doing that, I'm going to invite DCBS to come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-chairs and members of the committee, this bill requires non-depository, non-governmental third-party mortgage loan services that service over 5,000 loans to obtain a license from DCBS to service a loan, engage in loss mitigation activities, or hold mortgage servicing rights. Certain entities would be exempt from licensing requirements. DCBS has determined that the measure will require a financial examiner position to process the license applications and perform compliance examinations that can be covered by fees charged to the licensees. There is an A5 amendment that would add the other funds expenditure limitation to accommodate the position.
All right, thank you very much. Gentlemen, my metaphor about the amount of time that we've got, the amount of ground we've got to cover, and the amount of food that's on the table seems to be working. Let's continue that trend.
Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, good bill should pass.
Excellent. You can have dessert.
This bill addresses what is effectively a hangover from the mortgage loan catastrophe in the 2008, 2009, 2010 period. If an institution is state chartered and services mortgage loans, a bank or a credit union, for instance, were able to regulate their behavior as the loan servicer. Similarly, if they're federally chartered, the federal government is able to deal with those instances, and we are actually preempted there. There's a middle category of entities that are simply mortgage loan servicers that aren't otherwise chartered as some kind of a financial institution, and they continue to be a significant problem with all of the things you've heard about over the years in terms of misapplication of payments and bad behavior and foreclosure activities and all those sorts of things. This is a bill that we brought to you last full session that we really needed more stakeholder work on. I think over the last interim we've done that stakeholder work, and we were able to bring you a consensus bill. And with that, I'd like to turn it over briefly to Rick Blackwell to talk about the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Blackwell.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Gomberg, Johnson, and members of the committee. I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager for the Division of Financial Regulation. Noting the time, so we would be joining 33 other states in requiring a license for this type of activity. As Director Allen noted, we did go through a stakeholder process to make sure that we were focusing really on the regulatory gap. That's the particular non-bank servicers that were providing these administrative functions of collecting payments. So essentially, the bill requires licensing of those entities. We codify certain minimum standards for servicing, which is make sure that you're collecting and applying loan payments properly, managing escrow accounts, that sort of thing. Prohibited certain practices, which are really standard across the nation. Having it in Oregon law really does give us the ability to be accountable to Oregonians that do come to us with complaints. As I may have mentioned before, we've had around 950 complaints in the last 5 years on this activity, which is about 80% of our volume of complaints around mortgage. So it really is an issue for which we felt compelled to act. This would allow us to take up and resolve those complaints through a range of administrative actions consistent with other programs that we have in the department. And then finally, make sure that entities are solvent to try to minimize disruptions in the market if an entity does happen to go insolvent and put a lot of people's mortgages in jeopardy. So with that, I'll go ahead and stop there and ask if there's any questions.
Any questions, colleagues? Oh, yes, Senator Monroe.
What's the nature of the -5 amendments, and are you recommending them?
Co-Chairs Gomberg, Johnson, Senator Monroe, the -5, if I recall, is really just to make sure that the expenditure limitation is in place for the one position that we've requested as part of the bill. So,
okay.
Other questions? Is there anybody else? Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify to us today on Senate Bill 98? If not, I have already opened the work session. Is there an LFO recommendation regarding any amendments?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, LFO recommends adoption of the -A5 amendment.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the adoption of the -A5 amendments to Senate Bill 98.
Thank you. Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move Senate Bill 98 to the full committee with the amended 98 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Thank you again, Co-Chair. Colleagues, any discussion? Yes, Representative Dearman.
So I'm reluctant to start up a new regulatory regime on this, especially in light of the fact that I think that people still have a judicial process that they can go through, i.e. you can sue your mortgage servicer. And another thing, I'm just surprised to say that there's 950 cases in the last several years, and we don't have any victims that feel compelled enough to testify on this, so I'll be a no on this.
All right. I appreciate your feedback. Anything else? Yes, Representative.
My comments are similar, so I'm not sure we need to create another bureaucratic regulatory system.
Noted. Anything else? All right. Then I would ask, is there objection? I suspect there will be two. Do we have that for the record? And I'm going to declare that the measure carries, and we will need carriers to full and to floor.
I'll do full and floor.
All right. Senator Johnson will take this to the Senate and to the full Ways and Means. Anybody over here want to take this to the House?
Whatever you need, sir.
All right. Representative Reardon steps up valiantly. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 98. And I am going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 860. And again, Ms. Bushman.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, this bill requires DCBS again to conduct examinations of health insurers to review reimbursement parity and utilization management procedures for behavioral health mental providers as compared to medical providers and mental health providers with prescribing privileges. We have two amendments today. The A2 amendment changes the term plan to carrier. That clarifies the applicability of the bill to insurance carriers as defined by statute. And the A4 amendment gives DCBS the other fund expenditure limitation they need to charge fees and get the examinations done.
Excellent. All right, I have about eight people signed up, and I'm going to invite the first three from OIMHP to come forward, if you would. And while you're coming, I'll use a completely different metaphor, and that is, I think if we've got about 3 minutes per person, we would do well. My metaphor is that, like in budgeting, if one budget gets more money, it means we need to take money away from one of the other budgets. So we're starting out with 3 minutes allocated each, but if you want to divide up your 9 or 10, I'll let you decide how to do that. Please.
Thank you, co-chairs and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing the Oregon Independent Mental Health Professionals. We're a statewide association, multidisciplinary mental health professionals, including licensed professional counselors, licensed clinical social workers, and psychologists. A lot of good people and sister associations have been part of the process to develop Senate Bill 860, which asks that DCBS conduct the requisite examinations that really answer the question, do we have mental health parity in the commercial marketplace, or do we have it just in name only? And our contention is that we have it just in name only. DCBS is authorized by Senate Bill 860 to look at commercial insurance policies under four different lenses, which really get to the heart of the question. My friend Pat Mooney will get into those four elements of the bill, but again, it's really meant to discern whether we have mental health parity in the commercial marketplace or not. And the bill does subsequently give DCBS some enforcement authority to where they do discover disparities that they are authorized and to remedy those disparities by rule or by other means. We also know that there are other amendments, including the -2 amendments, which have been brought forward by DCBS. We are in support of those and want to put that on the record. And we do support Senate Bill 860.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator.
By rule or other means, could you put some sideboards on other means?
Thank you, co-chairs and Senator Johnson. That's a term of art that was put into the bill, probably at DCBS's request, because we didn't want to hem them in.
That's
to
what
just,
bothers me.
To just rulemaking. But I presume it is something less than rulemaking that the department could engage in that would rectify those disparities that they find. But my understanding is that the department will be testifying, so you could probably
Is the department signed up? Okay. Mr. Allen, will if the chair is willing, have you come up and clarify that? Thank you.
Ready? Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
My name is Patrick Mooney. I'm a licensed psychologist practicing in Salem. The problem with enforcing the laws that exist, the federal and Oregon mental health parity law, is that there are about 8,000 procedure codes on that cover medical and surgical benefits, but only about 10 or 15 of these codes are used by psychologists, social workers, and licensed professional counselors. So it isn't spelled out clearly what is compared to what in order to determine how do you go about establishing parity between mental health and medical services. This bill takes a look at physician office visits as a decent parallel to mental health counseling. If over 50% of a physician's service with a patient is involved in counseling, all the physician needs to do is to establish how much time they spent with the patient and that they did counseling. So we believe it's a parallel metric to a lot of the procedure codes that are used for therapists who are billing time-based codes for doing counseling with their patients. There's once you've established that there's office visits is a good metric to compare, there's four basic pillars to this Senate Bill 860. First, it asks DCBS to review and remedy what the history of office reimbursement has been over time between the medical and mental health side. Most of our rates have been either flat or have gone down over the last 10 years. For some, for some insurance plans, it's even over the last 20 years. There's been very little bump in terms of reimbursement. This creates problems for people making a living, and a lot of people leave panels, which leaves a lot of Oregonians in the lurch when they find that they have an insurance benefit that they have nobody that they can really see. So the first thing to do is to take a look at the reimbursement rates over time. If the physician rates go up like that and the mental health provider rates go flat or down, this is non-equivalent benefit between medical and mental health. The second pillar would be to look at how these time-based office visit codes are treated, and are they treated in an equivalent manner. Currently, there's a lot of restriction in terms of care for mental health patients if they're being seen for a 60-minute session rather than a 45-minute session. The insurance plans are quite harsh, trying to restrict care to only saying that what's typical and required is only a 45-minute session to be for a patient to be seen. We wonder if that same kind of thing is being done over on the medical side of the coin. Are they also restricting longer office visits for physicians? If not, this is the kind of situation that needs to be remedied. I'm sorry, the hors d'oeuvre part, I'm trying to digest that right now. So the third pillar of Senate Bill 860 addresses the policy and procedure differences governing medical and mental health office visits. And the question is whether there are policies in place to restrict longer office visits in the same way that mental health office visits are restricted. For example, through the Optum subcontractor, Providence Insurance restricts the payment of 60-minute sessions to very specific therapies, such as exposure therapy for PTSD and panic disorders. The question is there a parallel Providence policy that restricts longer physician office visits to only particular kinds of treatments for particular diagnoses? So does somebody have to have very severe diabetes in order for a physician to be allowed to see their patient for a longer period of time? This kind of restriction is going on routinely on the mental health side of the coin. And the fourth pillar of Senate Bill 860 is basically trying to establish how reimbursement rates are determined for both medical providers and mental health providers. For example, are physician rates established through a standardized type of Medicare relative value unit system, which is a system of work value. But mental health rates are established through more of a mental managed care kind of system. If there's not an equivalent process in establishing rates in the first place, this is also a violation of mental health parity. In summary, Senate Bill 860 will lead to the enforcement of the federal and Oregon mental health parity laws in ways that they were intended. The discriminatory way which insurance plans treat mental health care will come to an end, and Oregonians with mental health problems will not be treated as second-class citizens. Please support this bill.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mooney.
I have a Senator. Question, and I'm asking it of you, but by extension, I'm asking it of Mr. Allen in anticipation of his testimony. I'm trying to figure out what the workload is going to look like here for DCBS. This strikes me as a phenomenal workload, and I'll let Mr. Allen disabuse me of that. But if we start trying to parse whether or not a medical doctor is, let's say, counseling a woman on fertility options, that could be a fairly lengthy conversation. And I just don't know how DCBS is going to be able to parse the activities of medical doctors working with clinical disorders or medical problems versus the time in a psychologist's office. I also am not quite sure that I know where psychiatrists would fit into this structure. It's not that I'm not supportive of what you're trying to do, but your testimony gave me much more pause about this bill than I had walking in the room. And maybe Mr. Allen can touch on that, but I'm just trying to figure out how this is going to work.
I don't think that any examiner is going to get into the particulars of what goes on in the doctor visit or the psychologist or other therapist visit. It's not to look at that specifically. It's to look at the policies and procedures that these companies adopt in terms of restricting hours. You know, so if, for example, Moda restricts the longer psychotherapy, the payment of a longer psychotherapy visit to the same rate as they pay for a 45-minute session. So it would just be looking at something like, does Moda pay the same rate for a 45-minute session and a 60-minute session versus a physician visit that where they pay the same rate between a 25-minute session and a 40-minute session. In each side, there's like a 15-minute difference. On one side, on the medical, are they paying more just because they do? And on the mental health, are they just restricting care so that they're going to pay those only the same amount and basically artificially suppress, you know, the payment of the codes? I don't think it has to get into the details of what the content of the visit is, either on the medical or the mental health side.
I'll still be interested in hearing from Mr. Allen. Your testimony is just steeped in the bias, and I am concerned that this is going to present a significant problem. We can move on in the interest of getting the house back to the floor, but Mr. Allen has heard my questions and I think can speak to those.
And we'll be hearing from him in a little while then. All right, thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, and members of the committee. I have to confess, I'm steeped in the bias. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I work in Portland in private practice.
And I'm going to interrupt you and just ask you to give your name for the
record. I'm sorry, it's Tracy Bryce Farmer. When I first got out of social work school, I went to work at Providence Hospital to my great pride and delight. When I went into private practice, I discovered to my dismay that my patients who had Providence health insurance actually had really terrible health insurance for their ongoing mental health needs. It's an open secret in the city of Portland that there are several insurers who work with the carve-out company Optum, and that company routinely restricts care and kind of dogs a private practitioner's office with utilization review and kind of pressure to discharge patients right away. I'd like to paint a quick picture about what treating mental health is like. Right now, on our streets, in our schools, in our shopping malls, and indeed in this very building right now, there is a percentage of the population that deals with mental health symptoms that come from a genetic predisposition, but also many, many people who have experienced and survived what in our business we call adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. So people around us, all around us right now, are trying to live their life after having undergone childhood neglect and abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. The symptoms that come from this kind of background as a child include anxiety, depression, social isolation, self-loathing, suicidal ideation, so thinking that it would be better to be dead a lot of the time, and in fact, engaging in high-risk behaviors based on those feelings, drugs and alcohol, suicidal attempts, and sometimes even psychosis, seeing and hearing things that other people do not see and hear. So that's the bad news. The good news is that routine outpatient mental health care, coming to see someone like me or someone like Pat once a week and talking through what it's like to manage your life with these kinds of symptoms, is shown in the most current meta-analyses to be the most effective way to treat these conditions. Medication is useful, but medication without talk therapy results in poorer outcomes. I just got off my phone at lunch in the cafeteria just now and was checking into my professional listservs, where routinely we post for each other requests for referrals. So you might see something in the subject heading that says, seeking referral for Providence patient looking for addiction treatment, UBH patient looking for addiction treatment or a mental health treatment. And the line that I just saw at lunch, a therapist had written in the body of the email, I know it's hard to find a Providence therapist, but please, I just need one name to give to this person. The reality is that as a private practitioner myself with all my Providence patients, I can't afford to keep taking a lot of Providence patients. I might have to get off the panel because they pay me less than half of my usual and customary rate. So that you routinely hear Providence, UBH, UMR patients saying things like, I thought I had good mental health care. Why can't I find a provider who takes my insurance? How come my therapist is leaving my panel? How come they're leaving and I'm going to have to start all over again with somebody new? The reality is when this kind of access is closed down for patients, their symptoms are exacerbated. They become very ill again. They engage in high-risk behaviors again, and they end up in our emergency rooms, in our hospital programs, where I know they end up costing the insurance companies a lot of money. And as a social worker, I have to consider that federal and state social agencies also pay the price, and Oregonian taxpayers pay the price for taking care of people when we don't take care of them on a regular basis. I want to thank you for listening to my very biased perspective. Obviously, I feel very passionately about this work, but I do think that there is a big social and fiscal cost to not providing parity in mental health treatment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this group? Yes, Representative Gearman.
I'm trying to be sensitive of the time here, but I've rarely had a bill, such a disparity between the length of the bill and my inability to understand what's really going on. And I appreciate your testimony because I think it helped. But what's the problem here? Is it just that mental health providers are not being paid enough? Is that really all it is?
I appreciate that question because it isn't just that. When I left Providence, I was really anxious to provide that population, including some of my former patients, with mental health care. So I got on that panel. And as soon as I did, Representative Nierman, I found out that that particular panel was going to make my life in my office really difficult. Not only were they going to pay me less than half of what some of these other companies paid me, but they call me all the time. When I reach a certain number of visits with a patient, they call and they say, well, what procedures are you doing for this person? I have to go through all these utilization reviews, which then never pan out. Even though I go through those practices and I use a lot of my day-to-day time to conduct these reviews, I am always turned down for the longer session code. I am pressured to discharge patients to kind of get them out the door. And I know if I do that, if I get them out the door, they're going to get really ill again. That's what's going to happen. So that's kind of the daily reality. And the fact that on my listserv at lunch, I've got, you know, people, it's a common knowledge. If you got Providence, if you got UBH, if you've got United Healthcare, oh my God, that's the worst. You'll never find a therapist. If you do, they won't see you for long. They'll eventually get off your panel because therapists can't survive on that reimbursement. So I think the reimbursement rates and the utilization practices directly impact access for patients. Thank I don't you. Know if that clears it up or helps.
It helps. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you all. I'm going to invite, we've got four more people I need to hear from today. I'm going to invite David Beam and Melissa Todd. Thank you very much.
Hi. Go ahead, okay, thank you. Hi, my name is Melissa Todd. I am a licensed psychologist with a private practice in Eugene, and I am also a member of the OIMHP. And I think that my testimony is a good one to follow Tracy's, because I am one of those providers that recently made the very difficult decision to leave the UBH Optum panel. I agonized over this for 2 years, and I agonized because I felt like I would be letting people down, people who I care about, people who I work with. And in Eugene, the network for UBH Optum United Providence is woefully inadequate. And I knew that my decision to leave would only contribute to that. But I have very specific reasons for making this decision, and I want to detail these to you now, and I hope that these will help you understand the effect that these restrictions have on us providers. And I don't know if UBH Optum or United puts the same restrictions on medical surgical, but I'd like to know. I would like to empower somebody to find out whether they are similarly restricted, and if we are being restricted and they are not, then that's a violation of mental health parity. So, in my opinion, the practices of UBH Optum discourage providers from working with people with more severe mental health problems. I feel like I'm being asked to discriminate, and there's several reasons why. First of all, people with more severe mental health problems typically need more care. They need longer appointments. They need more case management outside of our appointments. And we only get reimbursed for face-to-face time. And so what ends up happening is if I meet with somebody for an hour, I bill 45 minutes. And so I'm underbilling constantly because for me, it's not right for me not to provide them with appropriate care. So I'm going to provide them with appropriate care and I'm going to bill for 45 minutes, even though I'm with them for an hour or sometimes even more than an hour. And that doesn't seem right to me. The first time I ever billed a crisis appointment, a crisis appointment happens when you're working with somebody who's in acute crisis, often suicidal, and you are trying to prevent them from moving up to a higher level of care. It's very intense. It's very hard work. It often goes long. The first time I billed UBH Optum for a crisis appointment, I was shocked to find out that it reimburses 25% less than a regular appointment. What message does that send to us? That if I see somebody in crisis, I'm actually going to get paid less than when I see somebody who's not in crisis. And so what do I do there? Do I accurately bill and take the 25% loss? Or do I inaccurately bill, get 25% more, but have it on record that this person is less acute than they actually are? The next thing, reason why is that...
Excuse me, Ms. Todd.
Yes.
I apologize. I want to make sure we've got time for everybody. I've got four people left in about 10 minutes. So
yes.
How much more did you have for us?
I will get through it quickly.
All right. And I apologize for nudging you along.
No problem. I appreciate it. So the other issue is these reviews. If I see somebody more than 20 times over 6 months, I'm automatically reviewed. If I see somebody more than one time in a week, which often happens when somebody's in crisis, I am automatically reviewed. And that's intimidating and it puts a lot of pressure on us. I find the reviews to be antagonistic and to be designed to reduce care. We are pressured to titrate down care. And if we don't do that, we are told that the services we're providing are not effective. So repeatedly, we are given the message that we need to reduce care and not work with people who have more severe issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A quick question.
Please.
Yes.
Do you enter into a contract with an insurance provider?
Yes, I do. And with UBH Optum, I was very new to private practice and did not know how this was all supposed to go. But I did apply to be on their panel and unknowingly signed a contract without being given my fee structure. And so I was entered into a contract without knowing what these parameters were going to be.
I guess I just wanted to get that on the record.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a contract. You had the chance to read the fee schedule.
I did not. They did not give it to
you
me.
You signed a contract without the fee schedule?
I unknowingly signed a contract during the application process and was not given a fee schedule. With the other companies that I went with, they gave me the fee schedule and the contract at the same time.
Shouldn't that have been a clue that you should have asked for the fee schedule with this one?
I was a brand new provider to private practice, and I'd never done this before, and I didn't know how it was supposed to go. I felt like I was taken advantage of.
Thank you, Ms. Todd. Mr. Beam.
My name's David Beam. I'm a spokesman for all the disability people in the state of Oregon. We need a mental health system better for Oregon because a lot of disability people can't read and write in the state of Oregon, can't get services for mental health issues. So you got emergencies. I'm trying to set up a 24-hour drop-in center for each county in the state, get this done for each county. I got 9 counties wants it right now. For Marion County wants it, Marion Polk County wants it, Eastern Oregon wants it, Bend wants it, Oregon City wants it. So I'm asking the state is we can fix the mental health problem now, get it done, get it on the floor, and get it passed, because we need it for special needs population and seniors and disabilities. And the ones that really need it, your services after 5 o'clock, need it really now for the police departments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bill. Any questions for this group? All right, thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up Dan Cushing and Rachel Wiggins. And for anybody who's listening in on the hearing, I'll just remind you that that this bill has been heard in a policy committee in a lot more detail. So if it seems like we're rushing through, we are covering some ground that's already been covered a little bit. I'm glad to see the two of you here with us today. Who'd like to go first?
I'll go really quick. My name is Dan Cushing. I'm here representing the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon chapter. On behalf of our 1,500 members in Oregon, I just want to say that we are in support of this bill. Many people don't know this, but social workers are trained in mental health, and many of us provide talk therapy, including in private practice. And you just heard from a licensed clinical social worker who did a much, much better job than I can, but I just want to express our support, and I'll yield the rest of my time to Rachel and Mr. Allen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cushing.
Great. I will be quicker. Rachel Wiggins Emery here on behalf of the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations for Counseling and Therapy in support of Senate Bill 860. Essentially, we agree with everything that's been said by the providers. This bill is about access to mental health, and we strongly encourage you to support it.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Just a quick question to either one of you. Is it typical that you see contracts coming that they sign the contract as part of the application process but are not given the fee schedule?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and Representative Meek, I can't speak exactly to whether our members review the fee schedule all of the time, but I know that part of it, too, is in the way that the rates, the methodologies are applied in actually seeking reimbursement. And a lot of times, too, you may have the fee schedule available, but a lot of those rates haven't increased for several decades, whereas on the physical medical side, you have seen rates increase roughly equivalent to the cost of living increases.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair.
Other questions?
Question.
Yes, please.
I just want to make sure I understand what we're doing here. Does this bill actually help increase access because more people will be providing service, or does it put it on a parity with, say, a medical condition? You know, if that makes sense.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and Representative Reardon, this bill doesn't actually increase any existing requirement. It simply seeks to find out whether existing law, which is mental health pay parity, which is the law of the land here in Oregon, is the case. And as has been said before, our members report anecdotally that it is not, and there have been extensive surveys that I know that OIMHP has conducted regarding reimbursement and the methodologies for determining reimbursement for these different time codes. So the hope is that, yes, by ensuring that mental health pay parity is followed, that we will stop the further limiting of provider panels and thereby increase access.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Director Allen, there's a few morsels of time left in our buffet. And I think you heard some of the questions that that were presented. So if you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just very quickly, there was a question about rules or other steps, which I think is the language that's in the bill. We would interpret other steps to be things like bulletins, which we issue, which follow the APA in terms of their development or educational sessions or conferences or other kinds of things where we try to make provider or carriers and providers aware of what the requirements are. So I don't think there's anything, no actual torture or anything like that involved in that turn of the phrase.
Thank you.
To Senator Johnson's question about the scope of this, this is a big scope, but this is a serious issue, and it's one that the agency had already been gearing up and has actually been doing significant work over the past several months. And you might recall, within the last 3 or 4 months, we've engaged in enforcement actions with a number of carriers related to autism spectrum disorder treatments in pursuit of those kinds of issues. issues. We have, you've previously approved and budgeted for us a $1.2 million federal grant to help do this very work of assessing the implementation of mental health parity. And so this really is very consistent with that work that we've been gearing up for some time to be able to do. And we think it is a big issue, but it's one that we think is properly scoped and that we've got the resources to be able to pursue. With that, I'd be happy to answer other questions you might have.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I don't pretend to know anything really in depth about physical health treatment or behavioral health treatment, but I do have a family full of medical practitioners, and I hear a lot of similar stories when it comes to insurance companies trying to control treatment, both in home health, in clinical settings, in therapy, or in surgical settings, as well as the pay issue. My bigger question, if this is currently a law, I have a concern, just my own little soapbox, of creating a law to study the ability to enforce the current law. And that's what it sounds like to me. And you mentioned that you're currently gearing up and you're currently, what's prohibiting us from currently enforcing medical or mental health parity?
Co-chairs, Representative Noble, I think one of the things that we have struggled with through the implementation of the Affordable Care Act is, on the one hand, managing the implementation of the act itself, while on the other hand, managing the fact that we have lots more people in Oregon today who have access to medical treatment who didn't have it before. And so issues that have perhaps been bubbling below the surface for many of us now are kind of boiling over and become much more visible. This is an area that has become a focus in the last 2 years. These federal grants became available because of this very notion of these problems presenting themselves more frequently. And candidly, our agency, I would say, going back to probably 2007 or 8, had actually reduced some of its capacity in this area of compliance with insurance mandates and those kinds of things. And we've been working to rebuild that capacity, and this is consistent with that.
Follow up, please.
And coming from an occupation where I saw a lot of the people who didn't get the treatment, because I dealt with it in a law enforcement situation, you had mentioned that you'd already dealt with some current issues regarding autism, and I fully support all that. Is this bill necessary for you to actually enforce it, or is this just confirmation to keep doing what you're doing? I'm just still trying to figure out whether we need new legislation for you to follow the current law.
Sure.
Does this enable you to do something you can't do now?
Sure. Co-chairs, Representative Noble, I would say it does not enable us to do something that we can't do now, but it does provide some focus. The four pillars that you heard about are some very specific lines of inquiry that we may well have gotten to similar lines of inquiry on our own, but they give us some very specific direction, and so they're questions that you're effectively asking us to answer. To your earlier comment, though, I just want to briefly say, talking about your experience with other providers, I think there's a lot of passion and interest about a lot of issues directed at this bill, some of which are probably beyond the scope of the bill. What the bill does is give us actual written down on paper structure of the things that we need to pursue and look at and report back to you on, as well as to pursue if we, through this inquiry, find enforcement actions. And I think it's useful in that context.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to have to curtail the conversation at this point and ask Ms. Bushman, do you have a recommendation for us?
Why, Mr. Co-Chair, I do. LFL recommends adoption of the A2 and the A4 amendments to SB 860.
Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would move the adoption of the -A2 and the -A4 amendments to Senate Bill 860.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there objection to these two amendments? Seeing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I would move the amended Senate Bill 860 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Again, colleagues, any discussion? Yes, Representative Ehrman.
So just very quickly, I still have some questions about this bill, and I'm just going to do a courtesy no vote. I'm open to the possibility of being convinced, but I just have some understanding issues with this, so I'll be a no on it. And I'll put a note out there to anybody that wants to come to my office and the arms there for the twisting.
All right.
And despite the fact I'm making the motions, I'm probably going to be a courtesy yes and would appreciate the opportunity to have my arm twisted a little bit. I have some concerns about the bill as well.
All right. Anybody else have any concerns or open doors?
Mine's a courtesy yes.
Okay, courtesy.
There you go.
Representative Nierman? That's twice.
thank you. Rep. Gomberg, I think this is an extremely, extremely important bill that's going to make a difference in so many lives. When we get the information that we can have, we're constantly asking for information so we can make good policy decisions, and I think this is critical, and I will be a resounding yes.
All right. Thank you for that discussion. So for the record, are there objections to the motion? We have Representative Nierman objecting. Other than that, the motion carries. And I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing and work session on Senate Bill 860. Ms. Bushin, have you got anything else for us?
Carriers.
Oh, I'm sorry. We need carriers. Yes, absolutely. And Senator Hansel, will you take this to full and to the Senate floor?
Yes. You're
and yes, right. Representative Reardon will take it to the House floor. So we've got carriers.
Thank you.
Did we do the work session on the Yeah, we did.
Yes, thank you.
So I think we are caught up with our details for today. So, colleagues, I'll tell you, while we had a buffet down here, there was a banquet waiting for you upstairs in the House chamber.
That is the end of that metaphor. That is the end.
We are adjourned.
If you don't mind, I'll pass on.